All right, welcome in to our first 2020 episode of That's
So Cincinnati.
Happy New Year, Jason.
Happy New Year, Sherry. Jason Williams, my co-host Sherry Coolidge, my friend Sherry Coolidge, my other friend Silent, almost called you Silent Bob, Silent Phil, our producer. He's back. We're back. Happy New Year to everyone out there. Before we jump on, if you didn't hear our New Year's resolution episode last week, which posted New Year's Eve with leaders from all around the region sharing their New Year's resolutions for Greater Cincinnati. Go back and check that out. It was a really fun, quick episode.
It's my favorite episode.
I know. It was so fun. It was fun putting it together and fun having everyone in. Thanks to Denise Driehaus and Alex Triantafilou and
Bill Cunningham.
Bill Cunningham and Joe Dieters and Cedric Denson, Alicia Reese, and on and on and on. John Morris Russell. I'm trying to think. So many others. Victoria Morgan, thank them. Thanks all of them for coming in logistically to come into our office and our studio and share their resolutions for Greater Cincinnati. It was really a fun episode and may have been my favorite of the year. Actually, my favorite of the year was Mr. Greater.
It's like picking children. I don't know. when that's CEO, very hard to do.
CEO of Grater's Ice Cream came on. That was, I love having all of our guests on and hearing different stories and all
his
that.
This is the one that I've taken forward the most. Because, you know, Grater's is around us a lot all the time. And I learned a lot about how they do things. And like when you're out getting it or you're talking to someone and it comes up, like I have a lot now of like background and insight into it. And so I actually talk about it a lot now.
I know. It's funny. I was actually at Grater's just over the week, or not at Grater's. I was at Kroger over the weekend. I had a hankering for Grater's, so I just went.
Did you get the Bearcat limited edition?
No, I did not. I unfortunately, this was late at night. I had a real hankering for ice cream, and I went and I did what you shouldn't do, and I went and got ice cream at like 10 at night. But I went with – it was funny because what I saw, like now I notice it now because after our interview is that every label has French pot ice cream.
Yes.
And I went with the traditional because I'm a boring guy. I went vanilla. You can never go wrong. Well, I usually do. I'd like vanilla ice cream, but with black raspberry chip.
Okay. You know, there was a shortage at some point in the year, and I happened to be in Target. It's Jack's favorite. And I bought like 10 containers of it. And then there wasn't really a shortage, and they're still in the freezer mostly. But now if you have a hankering for ice cream at night at the Coolidge house, you can. It's there.
Anyway,
that's like I panicked. It was like a snowstorm was coming.
Once again, thank you for everyone listening in 2019 and your emails and encouraging us and recommendations for guests and, engaging in this on social media. Thank you so much. Looking forward to an exciting 2020. And with that, today's special guest right out of the gate here is local lawyer Brian Shrive, who's with the Finney Law Firm. Brian Shrive, that name sounds familiar to listeners. He's the citizen watchdog who's been right in the middle of this so-called Gang of Five text messaging case at City Hall as the citizen lawsuit's lead attorney. And so Brian is a
– it put him in really more of the day-to-day political conversation than he's ever been before.
Absolutely.
But he's been around for a while, you know, working with Chris Finney's law firm, loosely affiliated with Coast. And, you know, he did a lot of work. And we'll get to this in the conversation. It's on the list about, you know, a lot of the political workings of the Gene Schmidt campaign.
Yep. Gene Schmidt campaign. Brian's very active on Twitter. We're going to talk about – the streetcar and the sort of bus levy coming up this year with him. And he's going to share a little about his personal story. It's a unique story and what happened to him all led to where he is today in his career. So really looking forward to having him come in and talk about all those issues and himself as well. Sherry, before that here in a few minutes, let's get right to it here out of the gate in 2020 and talk about City Hall is here. I hear. I thought we'd be coming out of the gate and talking about all the crazy races in 2020, and certainly we will be. And I'm writing about a lot of those right now, taking a look at some of my must-see, must-watch primaries in Hamilton County and around the suburbs coming up this week on Cincinnati.com. But here we are, right out of the gate, Sherry. City Hall is the story of the first few days here.
A lot of stuff. I mean, not really, I think, things that are going to come to fruition, all of these conversations, or at least not immediately. I don't want to say never for some of these things. You know, my one of the biggest talker stories that I just kind of, I've been wondering forever about what was wrong with the C on the convention center. And because the C is blinking, and it turns out, you know, there is, they fixed it and it broke right away again. And they don't really know what's wrong with it. And that had, that was still, I mean, we're like, I'm a couple days into it at this point, and every conversation I have is like, people are like, oh, thank you. I was wondering what was wrong with the
C. Oh yeah. That was a huge story on, I believe that you posted that Friday on Cincinnati.com.
Yes.
And, that really got a lot of traction, and people were super interested. And it's amazing how something like that is so visible, and people are, you know, they get so interested in things like that. And certainly that has really become part of the, particularly from the west side, has become a very iconic symbol of the skyline.
You know, honestly, I was covering courts, I think, when it was put up. And I wasn't really paying attention. It kind of came out of nowhere, and I didn't love it at first. And now I love it. I love to see what they do with it and the different colors, and like if something's happening, what they kind of come up with to, you know, breast cancer month awareness, or there's a game of some sort. And like, I actually love that sign now.
So we're back to business at City Hall.
Yesterday is like three meeting day.
I wish I could say they were back to real business. But it seems to me like out of the gate here, it's business as usual for this city council. Monday, you had in the law and public safety, and we're going to talk about this a little bit with Brian as well, Shrive. You had the chairman, Christopher Smitherman, the vice mayor of the Law and Public Safety Committee, come out and spend several minutes on a motion to try to get the so-called Gang of Five text message group to repay city legal fees. And it's like, wait, didn't we start 2019 this way? And after a lot of things that had happened here recently in the police department and with policing, and wouldn't you think that would be, and when I mentioned that, I'm talking about Max Lomberg's big story on
traffic stops
and intersections, and looking at the racial breakdown of those, and the neighborhood breakdown, and how that's all. You would think that would be a big issue to tackle in the Law and Public Safety committee, but right out of the gate, we're talking Gang of Five. This is political grandstanding.
It did not pass out of
right here.
Nothing passed out of committee yesterday, which does not mean it will not appear on the Wednesday council agenda. The mayor does have the option to just put things on himself, so we're kind of watching for that. At the point this is being recorded, we don't have the agenda yet, but that, I mean, there's an option there. But it did not make it out of committee.
My take on that, Sherry, is, and I was on with Scott Sloan on WLW this morning as we record here on Tuesday. My take on that is keep that out of City Hall right now. Take that out on the campaign trail. If Christopher Smitherman wants to bang that drum and say, pay back this stuff, A, let the special prosecutor do his thing with looking into the dereliction of duty recommendation from the state auditor, and beat the drum of that these guys, ladies and gentlemen, should pay back the money. But to come out of the gate first committee meeting of 2020 and go right to that, it's like, come on. It's disappointing. It's disappointing. I hope it doesn't set a tone for 2020. But you wonder, is this going to be the same stuff we've been talking about at City Hall for over a year now? And, you know, we're now midway through this council's, 4-year term, final 4-year term. And
I mean,
here we are.
The citizens have spoken. We're in 4-year terms now. We're returning to 2-year terms, which we've traditionally had in the city. And at this point, if we were in 2-year terms, we would be swearing people in and with lots of ideas, and just really this brand new energy would be coming if we had a new council right now. And, you know, I'm really looking for that energy out of City Hall, because 2 years is a traditional term. A lot can be done. Things can be put in the past, dealt with, and a lot we can move forward with a two-year term. And I don't think that people should just be like, oh, this is the waning days. And of course, we ourselves talk about the 2021 election, but that does not mean that the business of City Hall needs to grind to a halt. There's two more years.
No, absolutely. I know you're going to be all over that here in the big. I'm hoping to focus a lot on the 2020 election because it's, as we all know, it's such a huge deal.
The other things we did see yesterday are Councilman Jeff Pastors, you know, really wants to have a look at whether McMicken needs to be renamed because of, you know, the he was a slave owner, and they did this at UC for the College of Arts and Sciences building. They removed his name, even though he was a large landowner to the university. Changing a street name is no small business. It's not, he's not thinking honorary, like an actual where every single person has to change their address. It's a lot of paperwork. It's a lot of expense, and it's a conversation worth having, but that, you know, it's coming very quickly. It didn't get out of committee yesterday. And then we saw, then we had the same conversation we have every single year. Should the property taxes be raised, which council ultimately decided not to do that? But at this point, it seems like a dog and pony show. You're not going to do it. Don't do it. Just say you're not going to do it instead of like grandstanding on it. It was a day of meetings yesterday that really resulted in not a lot of things happening.
And then we come into today, and you popped the story this morning on Cincinnati.com about Chris Seelbach introducing a motion to try to get rid of the Mussolini-donated statue in
Eden
Park.
That story is kind of crazy. I mean, how that statue came to be and whether it belongs in a park or not. It was a conversation worth having. He did, you know, he backed off of the idea of having a motion right before he walked in here to record.
Oh, he did. Okay.
He did. Okay. But you know what? But he said, too, you know, it's a conversation worth having.
But I understand. I understand that. And my thing that look at what we've just kind of the list of folks think or things that we just ticked off here in the first really day plus of city of the 2020 city council. Priorities, folks, priorities. Got a police department that has some issues and really needs to be addressed. Got, I know I hate to keep banging this drum, but got some basic potholes and I know those aren't transformative things and those aren't sexy headlines and get you a lot of adulation.
Everyone loves a good pothole story.
Get you adulation in your social media vacuum, but that's what's important to the greater good of the people of Cincinnati. And that's my problem with things like these political moves here is that they're prioritizing politics over the people. And, you know, has there been a big outcry from the community about the street name of McMicken? I totally understand the reasoning for wanting to change
there it. There was, I will say, I do believe there was an outcry from students, which actually forced the university to take a very hard look about whether they wanted to do that. It was a very hard decision. It took many, many months of discussion and looking at it. So the outcry did, I would say, start there.
But you know, here what I'm saying is that has there been a big outcry about the statue? No, there hasn't. And so take care of the people's business. And then take care of some of your political pet projects. And that also goes for this text message thing. Absolutely no business coming out of the gate and making that a huge priority in the Law and Public Safety Committee, you know, right out of the gate here. Honestly, I don't think it should be discussed at all at City Hall unless, you know, until after.
We did see the FOP president on social media, you know, point out, we are still, District 5 is still in crisis mode. It's in a temporary place. There's no plan. They took all the money for it and they put it towards the Columbia Parkway fix, which that's being fixed now. You know, if you have to drive on it,
yeah.
That's going to just be a constant backup there. And you can even see there's more mudslides. They're just going right into the street. Mm. But, you know, he really wants to see a fix, and that fix is going to have to come out of that committee. And I don't know what that looks like at this point. There's been a couple iterations, but there's not one right now.
I will say that I want to add this about the statue. I say get rid of the thing because it's just incredibly weird. And it's just really, really a weird statue.
It gets to the mythology of everything, yeah. But I do think you're going to have a conversation when you walk by it to explain to children if they're looking at it.
Yeah.
You can see it. Albert Caesar, one of our photographers, took a beautiful photo of it this morning with the sun coming up and everything. So I urge, if you don't want to read the story, at least go look at the picture of it.
Anyway, yeah, that's all on Cincinnati.com. Currently, just honestly, just the easiest way to, is just to log on. So many of you are subscribers. Log on in the right hand corner on the desktop is their search queue, and I can't. Where's the search queue on the mobile? I can't think of it right, but it's there. The easiest way is just search for Sharon Coolidge, and you'll see all those stories we're talking about. Sherry, do you have anything else to add on a day plus here of city business, or so-called city business? Do you have anything to add on that, moving forward? Well, let me ask you this. What's two really important things that you think, or that City Hall should be, really tackle in 2020?
This is something they've said themselves, because I try not to weigh in on these things, but this is something they've said themselves, and it's something that I'm really looking at, especially I'm working on a story related to this right now, the affordable housing. Mm-hmm. There has to be a solution here somewhere. I don't know what it is. It's going to require a lot of money, and I don't know where they're going to get it, but we need to start having some real conversations about it. And in the 2 years, you know, they created an affordable housing trust fund. It barely has any money in it. And mm-hmm. I think that's going to need to be a priority in this coming budget. And then I think the other thing that we're really going to see is the city, they do have a deficit, not as bad as some years, but they do have one. But this city, I do think, is at a crisis level at some points that things need to be fixed because they've been ignored so long. We can't get to
long-term
the point
fixes.
Where Columbia Parkway is collapsing on itself and then it needs a $17 million fix. We can't get to a point of the 911 center where it's so underfunded and it's such a mess that Kyle Plush dies. We can't get to a point where there's so many problems in the public safety department that a worker is electrocuted and there's like several steps that could have been taken that could have prevented this, according to a report that was released right before Christmas. And so these are like these systemic problems inside City Hall because they haven't been funded in so long. And so I think these things are going to have to be dealt with. And some of these things are at a crisis point. And I don't envy them for having to deal with it. But when you're a council person, that's your job.
That's exactly right. It's hard work. But put aside some of the political whatever, yucky stuff on text messages and all that. Take that to the campaign. Address these things you're talking about. These are real things. That was Sherry. You were on a roll there. I really appreciate you.
I think you're going to be reading a lot about it because these things are starting to crystallize.
Yep.
Working on stories related to these things.
Let's shift gears.
I'm not above writing about statues and parks, just to be clear. it's a good mix of things.
Let's shift gears and jump over and bring in Finney Law Firm attorney Brian Shrive. All right, special guest segment time here on the That's So Cincinnati podcast. We welcome onto the hot seat the man that Cincinnati Democrats, progressive Democrats, really can't stand, and he loves that. Local attorney and citizen watchdog, Brian Shrive. Brian, it's great to have you on. And I know I should have introduced you also as a loyal listener to this podcast.
Absolutely. It's one of my favorite podcasts to listen to every week.
Thank you.
And a man who's also very active on Twitter.
I've put a couple of tweets out there, I guess.
I think it's more like not afraid to say what you're thinking on Twitter, but we'll let listeners go and take a peek for themselves. It's at Brian Shrive, right?
Exactly, at Brian Shrive. My wife obviously is not on Twitter. You can that's mostly why I'm so freewheeling with that.
Well, I'm not even sure why we're having you on here, because we don't really have a whole lot to talk about, do we?
It was a pretty slow year last year for us. Maybe 2020 will be more.
I'm going to put the agenda out there. You know, right before the new year, we did see the five council members were referred for special prosecution. It's not something we've talked about on the podcast yet because it just, I mean, right before Christmas that broke. So we're going to talk about that a little bit. We're going to talk about the streetcar. Jean Schmidt, you have a lot of very good Jean Schmidt stories that are perfect now as she's reemerging as a candidate. And I feel like also we have a bus, you know, levy coming up, and you've had a lot to say about that. So we're going to have, I think, a freewheeling conversation. That's today's agenda.
Looking forward to it.
Well, just like we started 2019, we start 2020 with the Gang of Five in the headlines. As Sherry referenced, the special prosecutor looking into state auditor's recommendations to pursue criminal charges. Yesterday, or as we record this on Tuesday, on Monday, Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman and his Law and Public Safety Committee was really pushing a motion to try to get the so-called Gang of Five, self-proclaimed Gang of Five, to repay legal fees to the city taxpayers. Brian, where do you stand on this? Let's start with the state audit and the special prosecutor. Do you think this is what should happen?
I think that in a normal, typical open meetings violation, you would not and should not see the state auditor referring the case for prosecution. People make mistakes, and we do public records and open meetings lawsuits throughout the state of Ohio. People make mistakes, and when they get caught, they get stopped, and they move on. In this case, though, I think the text messages that were released show that this wasn't just a mistake. This was a specific intent, an attempt to avoid public scrutiny. You look at the exchange, I think that Sherry, you had on in one of your stories where Greg and PG go back and forth, Landsman and PG go back and forth saying, I don't think we can do this. This is an illegal meeting. And they said, well, okay, well, we'll have four of us call in and then we'll call you later. And Greg actually rightly says, that's illegal too. But they still did it. And so they knew they were breaking the law.
I mean, these conversations basically, we did learn, started from day one of their term 2 years ago now. It's been like the longest 2 years of everyone's lives, I do think. And it all really kind of then came to light in a big fight over whether Harry Black should be the city manager, which of course, you know, he was eventually ousted during all of this. I mean, it's just been a saga, you know, but it has dragged out of, you know, with lawsuits, ancillary, your lawsuit, you know, pointing this all out, in which they did admit. I mean, I think that's like the very important underpinning of this. Like, this isn't just something that they're looking at. These five council members did admit they did this in the civil suit that you did bring on behalf of citizen Mark Miller, which is right. Important because a lot of times it's like, Brian Tribe did this. Technically, this is a citizen notice what was going on, Mark Miller, and he hired you.
Exactly. And the reality is, as you point out, the final entry, which was signed off by the city's attorneys, is an admission, is really, you can take the special prosecutor could take that right into a grand jury and say, here's every element of the crime and get the indictment if he wants to push that.
Let's go.
We're at a very serious point in it, though, with the idea that, you know, was this actually, you know, criminal in nature and does there need to be a prosecution? Jason, you had a column on it, you know, over the holidays.
Here's – I want to ask you this, Brian, as the legal expert. Let's go back, and I hate going back because we're really going back here on this, and there's so much dwelling on it. However, I think they brought it on themselves in a lot of ways. Let's go back and say, in your civil case, they admitted the wrongdoing of breaking the meeting open meetings law. Had all of them come out and been sincerely contrite and saying, hey, we're really sorry. This will never happen again. And you take away the fact that Wendell Young destroyed evidence and the whole thing. If you just look at it on the surface as they violated an open meetings law, take away some of the content between individual council members. Do you think if they would have been truly contrite that this would have been over?
Yeah, I think so. And in reality is, you know, shortly after we filed the suit, we reached out to the city solicitor's office and said, as we do with really all of these sorts of cases, look, you know, it's a dead bang winner. Let's not waste any money. Here's what our bill is so far. Agree to the injunction, pay the forfeiture, pay our attorney's fees, and we can and we can be done with it. And that and in this case, we said, and give us the 3 weeks worth of text messages, or the, you know, give us the March 1st to March 18th, I think it was, text messages. And the city just said, we're not going to give you the text messages.
That weren't very, these text messages were very important to the context of what was going on at the time that the city manager was being ousted. Those conversations, you know, a lot of extra things have come out since then, and whether they're relevant or not, we won't get into right this second. But those 3 weeks worth of text messages are very, very important to the business of the city, which is, you know, what public records are all about.
Well, and they showed really how they debated, and they proved, as Judge Ruhlman said, that the those council meetings that occurred in the beginning of the year were fake. I mean, four of the council members may not have known that they were participating in a fraud, but the other five certainly knew that this was a fake meeting, that the discussion was just there as kind of a show for the people. And you look at, you know, it started, those illegal meetings really started with the Rayshon Mack appointment to the SORTA board, which, you know, I think we can tie, you know, we'll tie into our other, you know, the SORTA tax discussion. But because P.G. Sittenfeld didn't like Rayshon Mack, thought, you know, took personal umbrage at some of the—
Rayshon Mack, who was a supporter and a friend of Vice Mayor Christopher Smitherman.
Right.
I might add.
Yes.
I think that there was some opinions about, I love Twitter. Everything's on Twitter.
Right.
But things he said on Twitter they thought were inappropriate.
Right. They didn't, they took umbrage with some of his tweets.
Which I actually am not criticizing them for. It just needed to be a discussion that needed to be in public. Which, you know, honestly, they do have the discussion. They have the discussion behind the scenes, and then they do have it in public.
Right. But it wasn't a real discussion, right? It was just reading off a script at that point. You know, Rayshon didn't know that had already been decided. You know, if he had known that the decision had already been made, he could have avoided the embarrassment. I don't think he has anything to be embarrassed about personally. I think he acquitted himself quite well. And you can take issue. Some people can certainly take issue with the content of his text. I think the tweets. I think one of the tweets was he. You know, basically said that, and I don't disagree with what he said. What he said was that the policies that P.G. Sittenfeld is pursuing are more racist than anything Donald Trump says, or just as racist as anything Donald Trump says. I don't know that, you know, get into whether you think Donald Trump says racist things or not, but the reality is a lot of these policies that P.G. Sittenfeld does support do harm African Americans in real ways. So Rayshon,
I don't want to leave that there as like a fact. There's a lot of debate about that, and he certainly would disagree
with that.
But
these forced union jobs that keep African Americans from being able to participate have certainly been, you know, and it's a debate. It's fair. It's a fair debate. But I agree with him. I agree with his premise. But maybe he said it a little too harshly. But I think the attacks on him were unnecessary, and the fact that it was done, that they put this whole attack together kind of behind the scenes is the problem. And I think ultimately, SORTA is the worse off for not having Rayshon's voice on the board.
A real bus rider.
Well, let's jump to, I think what gets lost maybe in the politics and the back and forth and the Twitter wars and all that and this whole thing is that there were actually some real there was real precedent set here in that your lawsuit ultimately led to now text messages between two elected officials are now in Ohio law are now considered a part of open records in Ohio law.
I think to a degree. I mean, I think there was an Ohio Supreme Court case that was a little ambivalent on that or ambiguous on that. And to be fair, it wasn't my lawsuit. It was actually the Enquirer's lawsuit and Channel 12's lawsuit.
Correct. Yep.
That ultimately and Jeanette Levy and made the request. And I want to circle back to the kind of the illegal conduct, right? The statute that the Gang of Five is being investigated under is for dereliction of duty. So not for
correct.
So recklessly not doing their job.
That they're currently being investigated by the right. special prosecutor appointed by Hamilton County Prosecutor Joe Dieters. Yes. Yeah.
So, but you think about it, they didn't do things they're supposed to do. The law requires them to do things. They didn't do them. And they did that. And if they did it, if that was negligent, no crime. But if it was reckless or worse, crime. And so everyone focuses on the illegal meetings, right? But it's not just the illegal meetings that they did that was against their duty. You know, we asked for the text messages and they didn't give them to us until we had to sue. Everyone knew those were records. They can sit there and say, oh, it was precedent setting. Well, certainly the five,
the quorum ones were
records. Those were minutes of a meeting.
Correct.
And they didn't turn them over. And then we requested the documents and Wendell destroyed them. I mean, those are crimes. Those fall within the definition of dereliction of duty.
They did look at Wendell for contempt of court, which the judge ultimately decided not to pursue. So I feel like we need to be very clear about that.
Yes. Right. The contempt of court was an issue of when, and I think
that had to do with the destruction of records. The records were destroyed, but, you know, a judge determined.
Well, it was a timing question.
And Wendell's attorney admitted that the records had been destroyed.
Correct.
Yeah.
And the question was the timing. Was it before or after the judge's order, which we can argue about. But
you were ready. You brought all those exhibits in with timelines and everything. Yeah. We didn't really end up getting to that point. Yeah. I mean, honestly, this has been just a two-year, like, day-by-day kind of thing. And I did think we were moving a little bit past it when we did see the state auditor. Honestly, not that long after everything, because it all, kind of accumulated in March and then – I don't think 7 months is honestly too long for a state auditor.
No. And he had
look
announced
at something, although I think there's some arguments. They themselves, I think, would say the state auditor doesn't really have business here. But
well, I mean, his job is to oversee the enforcement of these laws, so he does have a role to play. And he announced at the time that he was going to look into it. And I think another kind of shoe to drop, which I think Jennifer Baker reported, it was on the Enquirer website as well. That it looks like the Ethics Commission is looking into this as well. So there's probably another investigation in the Gang of Five's future besides just this special prosecutor.
Here's my thing. Ultimately, the blame is on the five for if they would have just put the hubris aside and their arrogance and said, hey, we violated open meetings laws by holding this meeting, came out, said we're sorry. You know, they paid their fine. You guys, your civil suit happened, like you said, forgotten about the fact that Brian Shrive is a member of Coast or has been a member of Coast as a Chris Finney protege. Just put all that aside, said, you know what? We did it. We're sorry. Period. Moved on. None of this stuff will be happening. However, no, there's no however here. That is the problem. I will say, though, that it's now become the other side has really, I think, has gone overboard and piling on. And I'm not talking about you. I think that you as a citizen watchdog and lawyer, you do your thing. My thing is when a government official, the state auditor, I think he took way too long on this. I think he probably could have looked at this and said, you know what, the locals took care of this in the civil suit. I'm going to pass. But it reeks of political hubris from his standpoint in that, he's trying to, Keith Faber certainly has aspirations to run for attorney general and potentially maybe governor someday. And it just reeks of, I want to try to get attention in Southwest Ohio where a lot of state officials have a hard time getting traction here.
Yet he really was nowhere other than the actual, it was Joe Dieters who really shared little parts of that audit with everybody. It was not him himself. There was no interviews. There was no press conference from him. Like,
I'm not sure this rose to the level of a criminal criminal.
Yeah, I mean,
behavior.
I think it's a standard, a typical Sunshine Law violation or open meetings violation shouldn't and wouldn't rise to it. But here, because there was obviously the intent to violate the Sunshine Law. And I think that, the offensive part, my guess, and I haven't had any conversations with the auditor, but my guess is the auditor was offended at the price tag, right? That they went out and hired these outside attorneys. And that was, I think there's going to be, there's more to be said on that these guys cooked up, that P.G. Sittenfeld and Chris Seelbach cooked up the Derek Bauman intervention. which is what kind of led to the quote unquote
creates a conflict. Then we need the outside attorneys, $176,000 it cost taxpayers, right, instead of just using the in-house counsel.
Right, exactly. So they just they wasted $100,000, $170,000 just to get out from the response, you know, the city solicitor's office. And you look at, you compare, you say, you know, when the motion to intervene was filed to bring Smitherman in, Vice Mayor Smitherman could have called Paula Boggs-Muthing and said, defend me. I'm a city council member. You're my attorney. The taxpayers should pay to defend me. And Smitherman said no. He called his own attorney, wrote his own check. And if PG and Seelbach and Landsman wanted their own attorneys, they have checkbooks too. They could have hired their own attorneys, and instead they cooked up a fake controversy and conflict to foist it onto the taxpayers.
Well, I'm done with this topic.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. At this point, you guys can keep going. I think we'll just say that the judge, you know, determined that that was not an appropriate action, right, without using the words fake and cooked up.
Yeah. Well, I mean, like I said, we've got the email. I'm just going to say, I just want to make this one point. 2 days before the motion to intervene was filed, Ballman emailed a copy of the draft to PG and Seelbach. We have that email. We have the draft complaint. They cooked it up.
Did you say you wanted to move on, yeah, Jason?
Well, my ultimate summation of this is that the voters and the residents of, yes, Cincinnati have been forgotten in this whole thing, and they should be really upset. And let's let them now decide it. And I understand they're two of the folks on there cannot run again for council and or mayor, or they could run for mayor, I guess, but ultimately, they broke the public's trust by violating open meetings law. Then Wendell Young went and destroyed. Those were real. And then they did not show any contrition and apologize really sincerely. Other than Greg Landsman, I know there are people who argue that. I do think Greg Landsman was sincerely apologetic. But you know, so those three things right there are kind of my takeaways from this. And then, you know, then it's just a tangled web of so many other things from there that certainly, Brian, is going to continue to be a story well into 2020 here.
Yeah, I agree. And I think what I would be curious is from your take, from both of your perspective, the city council meetings seem like more like real meetings now in the last year and a half, that they're actually having discussions that
we certainly had a very contentious hilltop discussion in public, something that we did not see from the commissioners.
Yeah. Let's switch gears.
I'm happy to throw it out there. The commissioners instead chose to have, you know, secret emails that the Inquirer was suing over.
Right. Let's switch gears to more fun topics. Jean Schmidt is back in the news. She's making a comeback. You shake your head.
I just don't understand it.
I want to set this up, but Jean Schmidt's running for a state rep, former congresswoman. She lost to Brad Winship unceremoniously in 2012, and one of the masterminds behind helping Brad Winship win was you, Brian. You said you don't understand it. Talk about that and your thoughts on her being back.
And this isn't false modesty. I have to take umbrage with the term mastermind. I was certainly not a mastermind.
Sorry, I didn't mean it. But I didn't mean it in a negative way. You did legal work for Brad Winship's campaign and helping him get elected.
I didn't take it.
Much like in the council races, though, that lawsuit exposed a lot of problems. And then that became part of the campaign. Well, you didn't make those. You just expose them through.
Correct.
Well, I didn't take it as offensive.
Yeah, sorry.
No, my point was I don't want to take more credit than I deserve. Gotcha. I was, I like to say I got Congressman Winship to the church on time. He did the important work. But as far as the work I did with Jean Schmidt was, I was in law school in 2009. Chris Finney was a friend of mine, and was working, defending David Krikorian in a lawsuit that, Jean Schmidt had filed or a complaint at the Elections Commission. And in the course of that had discovered that this Turkish Coalition of America, a nonprofit that has connections to Turkish citizens and certainly in it appears to be the Turkish government, was paying her lawyers and was illegally, it turned out, illegally paying her lawyers to the tune of about $600,000. Mm-hmm. And so Chris called me and said, look, my client can't afford to pay you, but you love doing legal research. Can you do this for free and just see what you can find out? So I dug in to the rather Byzantine world of congressional ethics, and we put together the complaint, got it filed, and it took 10 or so months before they acted. But the Office of Congressional Ethics came out finding for a violation.
That is a high bar. That does not happen all the time.
And then the ethics committee ultimately kind of came into some agreement, kind of whitewashed a little bit, said, well, Jean didn't know. She didn't know her attorneys weren't being paid by her and were being paid by someone else. But ultimately, they said she had to pay the bill. She left office before she paid the bill. Mm-hmm. She set up a legal expense fund and received one donation from a Turkish guy, like a Turkish aviation firm that's owned by two Turkish nationals. So it was pretty clear that she was not really working in the interest, I think, of her local constituents. And in fact, on election day, I think the Enquirer reported, or might have been roll call or something, that reported that on election day on the primary, she was having lunch with the Turkish ambassador rather than at home helping gin up the votes at the polling locations. But as far as her return to office, I just say, I don't understand. Like, she's 70-something years old. She's got grandkids. Like, why in the world does she want to drive to Columbus? Like, it makes no sense to me.
Well, spinning this forward, will there be any efforts to bring a lot of this back up in this campaign as she faces an intense primary here? I think one of the biggest primaries to watch in the region when she faces a newcomer, Joe Dills, a small business owner, an Air Force veteran. And also an outsider candidate, Dylan Blevins, who on his website says God, guns, and Trump.
Yeah.
Do you think that this is going to be what happened in 2012 is going to be an issue in 2020 for her?
I think so. I think the Central Committee endorsement process in 2012, she did not get the endorsement against Congressman Wenstrup. And again, this year, Joe Dills got the endorsement against her. So I think, and one of the issues that was raised is the fact that she's got this history. And she's got a long history, really, of this sort of issue, right? She when she was in the State House before, she received some free Bengals tickets from a lobbyist and didn't disclose it. And when she was caught, she said, oh, I thought Boomer Esiason gave them to me, which you still have to disclose it, even if it was Boomer Esiason. So
this is going to be, I think, where we see how much money comes into play, because she is going to have money, you know, compared to her opponents, which, you know, to get her issues out there would take money for them to, like, make the act, you know, all the citizens understand what we are talking about here and really understand. And, you know, this is the kind of story, in hindsight, I do think that the Enquirer should have, you know, kind of covered the saga, the twists and turns and everything. And we really didn't back then. We did some overarching stories, but I'm not sure that it really was in the conversation. It's only in the years since, really, that it's kind of been like, if you talk about Gene Schmidt, this really does come up.
Well, and to that point, at the time, having, you know, living through it, you know, it was like every day I was beating my head against the wall. Like, why can't we get the Enquirer or local news media to cover this? I mean, this is big, you know, in my mind. And I was like, well, maybe I'm just crazy and this isn't that big a deal. But I mean, it was just so frustrating at the time. And then after the primary, I realized, thank God you guys didn't cover it, because had you, I think Gene would have known she was in trouble. And because you didn't cover it, she didn't know she was in trouble. And I think your lack of coverage and the media in general, lack of coverage is what helped us win the election in 2012. So I'm always grateful.
This is how politics works.
I want to stick with your involvement. You talked about in law school when you were helping Chris Finney. That was your first really work in politics back in 2009. Then you came and helped with Wenstrup campaign in 2012. Take go back to that. I wrote a column about you back in September of 2018, and you opened up to me about some things you had to overcome in your life. At the time, you had met Chris Finney, right? You were a waiter at a Hyde Park restaurant.
Yep.
And you met Chris Finney had just come in there to work, and you had met him, and you and
he was having dinner with his family, and I was waiting on him, and there was a local the whistleblower, the local I don't know if it's still around,
local blog,
and they had years ago
his faxed everywhere,
the old fax,
and
Chris and I actually knew Schifrin back then as well, the publisher, and Chris Finney's name was his name in that publication was called the Family Friendly Fascist Chris Finney, and so we paid. And I looked at his credit card, I saw his name, and I said, "Hey, are you the Family Friendly Fascist Chris Finney?" And he was kind of laughed, and his wife was just loved it. Diane thought it was so funny, and that's how we got to meet, and we became good friends, and we now work together. So.
And you talked about you had overcome an alcohol addiction. Your dad was tragically killed in a car accident, and you were you were really searching for a purpose.
Well, I was I was kind of in 2000. I think Chris and I probably first met around 2006 mm-hmm. or so. And I was, had just finished up my undergrad and was kind of trying to figure out what I wanted to do with life. And I knew I kind of wanted to go to law school and wasn't really sure exactly how. And was really, I guess you could say a late bloomer or whatever. I was kind of getting my feet under me later in life than I should have. And so I had a lot, I was kind of like enjoyed, having some fun with this or that. So, with the politics and being able to do that, and research was just kind of a fun little project. But I did that in, that was in like I said, 08, 09-ish when we put that work together.
Yeah.
And into 10.
Switch back to... Well, let me ask you. You talked about your dad and how that really. I'm trying to recall the column, but I remember you talking about your dad and how that really set you on a path to, really to where you are today.
Yeah, I started law school in 2008, and then in August of 2000 July. I'm sorry, July of 2009. As my dad was killed by a drunk driver, and he and I had, my parents divorced, and there's always those kind of issues, kind of father son issues that you have, and we had really closed all those issues up and had a good relationship, a good friendship by then. So it was a big loss when he died.
Yeah.
But he had been a big influence on me too, and to your point, I'm politically kind of the. On being on the conservative libertarian side. Mm. And one of the things I remember, and not just in politics, but just kind of in life in general and in business. And I remember he ran an engineering firm for a while. And when he took it over, they had this voluminous employee handbook. And they had this rule. And he'd go through them. He said, "Well, what's this rule?" And no one ever really follows that. What about this rule? Well, we don't really follow
that. Yeah, I remember this. Yeah, you were talking about
that. And he says, "Well, then get rid of it." If we have a rule that we don't enforce, it really undercuts the rules that we do want to enforce. So get rid of the rules we're not going to enforce and only have the rules that we really want to enforce. And that's kind of my view on politics, right? If we want to have a Wild West, if we want to have city council members texting and meeting illegally, let's do it. If we want to have, Avtab Perival using his state campaign funds to pay for his federal campaign, if that's the way we want to do it, let's do it. But let's everybody do it, and let's
get rid of the law, right?
Right. Let's get rid of
the law. And I know you talked about that, and that's why I wanted you to share that's where, and you've tweeted about it, you've talked about it, and I wanted you to share. But thank you for sharing that, and I know that's some personal stuff, but I know you've talked openly about it and how that's helped mold you into who you are today as a citizen watchdog and pushing on all these things. I think we got one other thing we wanted to ask you about, right? And that's.
Well, we do want to talk about the streetcar and the bus levy. So how much time do we have?
We're good. We got a few more minutes left.
Okay, so short takes.
Some
on
you've been tweeting about, and certainly you've been involved. Or you have a very strong interest in. And,
yeah. Well, I mean, as far as the streetcar, I mean, it's the boondoggle to end all boondoggles. And it was kind of funny. Chris Finney and I were just talking yesterday, and I was joking about at the 2013 Coast Christmas party, we had a streetcar pinata. And we were all excited.
Of course you did.
I remember you telling me, literally, as I'm driving to the party, the radio's telling the story that Flynn is flipping and PG's flipping and Mann's flipping and that the streetcar is going to survive. We thought had killed the streetcar in that election, and Flynn and Mann and Sittenfeld flipped and I'll tell that story real quick too. But so they, I always say they ruined my pinata party.
Is there photo evidence of the pinata?
I do. I'll send it to you. I've got it. I think I've got it on my phone. I don't know if I've got I know I've got it after we beat it up a little bit.
No, the streetcar does take a beating on a constant basis, and you have been very tough on ridership. But shouldn't we be at a point where everyone is just trying to make it better?
Well, no.
Yes.
There's a world of lemonade makers. I think Amy Murray is a classic lemonade maker. You give her a dozen lemons and she's just going to make lemonade, and you can do it the next day, and she's just going to,
she's never going to complain about. We have to run streetcar for 25 years. And what are we?
Well, do
3
we?
Years in? Yes. We have to return $40 million of the federal grant. I'm not sure that's the exact number, but it's very close to that.
But has anyone actually made the call to the feds to say, look, this has been an unmitigated disaster. Help us out. I mean, that's
I fundamentally reject my columns.
You're right, but I mean, you have. But has Cranley, has the city manager, has Sorda, has and I have.
Well, it did just come under city hall purview.
I called Wenstrup's office. I called Shabbat's office, and they both promised me that if the city calls on them, they will do everything they can to help the city get out from under that debt. So I've done more work to help the streetcar undo that mess than the city manager or anyone in city hall has. But I just fundamentally reject the idea of like, oh, when life gives you lemons, make lemonade. No, I don't make lemonade. I just don't do it. You give me lemons, I throw them back at you. So you give me a streetcar boondoggle, I'm going to let you know every day that that's a streetcar boondoggle.
Well, I mean, you just can't give up on things.
I don't have a problem with what you have to say about it.
I do think that you can't just, if something doesn't work right away, you don't just throw it away.
It's not that it doesn't work right away. It's never going to work. It's fundamentally not going to work.
We're what, 3+ years into this thing operating, in addition to all the things that happened?
There are some things that could be done, and to be fair, we have been promised them and we have not seen them that can, I think, help it.
But I had lunch in early 2013 or late 2012 with Terry Garcia Cruz, who was the CEO of Sorda at the time. And she and Christina and I had lunch, and she just begged us, just please, Coast, stay away from Sorda. Don't look into us. If you have any questions, just call us. Don't sue us. Please, please, please.
That seems like a very good lunch on her part.
And we said, look, we support the bus. We support buses. It's important, bootstrapability. It's important for people to be able to get to work, the doctor, shopping, things that make their lives meaningful, that provide for their lives. But we don't want a streetcar. And if Sorda stays out of the streetcar, we'll stay out of Sorda. And she promised us Sorda will stay out of the streetcar. And then 9 months later, 10 months later, Sorda jumped in bed with the streetcar.
Under a different CEO.
Under Sorda.
Mayor as well, right? What year was that?
That was a different mayor. But she was still the CEO at the time, I believe. We have a CEO, a different CEO now. In kind of leading into the final topic of the Sorda tax,
bus system is woefully underfunded. It needs a lot of fixes. It needs new buses. It needs better routes. I mean, there's no dispute about this.
The question is, do we trust the system that's in place, that was the same system that was in place that lied about jumping in bed with the streetcar? And it was that 6 years ago said, we'll pay for the streetcar. Let's remember that. It wasn't just that we'll get in and operate the streetcar. The Sorda board voted to pay for the operating expenses of the streetcar. That was the vote. They said, we'll pay for everything. We'll cover the expenses. So they didn't have the money then, but they voted to do that. These are people that are fundamentally irresponsible, that can't be trusted. And I think until we completely revamp the sort of board and make it people that can be trusted. People like Rayshon Mack, who got...
This is a very broad brush to say these people are not to be trusted.
Let me bring this up. Can I say this? I think that's a little unfair. I understand the skepticism. I think it's a little unfair because from 6 years ago, it's an entirely new sort of board now. It's an entirely new CEO and top leadership. So I think, don't they deserve a shot here with...
They deserve a shot of the money they're getting now. They don't deserve a huge tax increase. I mean, I think they need to prove themselves first. If they can prove themselves first, but they've been, you know, but
so one of the things that they tried to do here was they got rid of this group of leaders on Sorta, moved the streetcar.
Possibly spurred by you.
Moved the streetcar off of their books, under their purview. They moved it over to the city.
Right. And let's, on that topic.
Which is what were hoping for all along, right?
That's not exactly true. That's not my hope. I met with Brendan Call for breakfast a year and a half ago or whatever. When they were first talking about the sales tax. It was kind of a similar, what can we do to keep you, to leave us alone? And I said,
How many conversations do you have like that?
I know, right? More than I probably should, I guess. I should maybe see a priest. But the fundamental question, I said, look, I'm going to oppose, I oppose this because I don't trust Sorta. I don't trust you guys with more money. But if you have any chance of winning, if you want to have any possible chance of winning your tax, you need to divorce the streetcar. Not for me. I'm not asking you to. Like, I never asked him to. It wasn't to satisfy me. It was political advice. This is what you need to do to win. But you're still not going to get my vote. And so, yeah, did they make the realization that being married to the streetcar was going to kill them politically? Yes, they did. Do they deserve credit for that? For they started the fire and they put the matches down and suddenly we say, oh, you're not starting any fires anymore. Well, you started this giant fire of a streetcar and we're supposed to be thankful that you stopped.
City council approved the project.
Right. But it was after the Sorta jumped in and said, we'll pay for it, and gave cover to Kevin Flynn for his flip-flop.
Silent Phil's giving me it's time to...
I knew this could be like a long-ranging conversation.
Sorry, Sherry. I want to apologize. Cut you off, but
totally
I want to give
fine.
You the last word in terms of you have a question, a comment. The floor is yours, Sherry.
I feel like all of these issues are very important. We need to get back to the business of City Hall. We need to make sure, whether this taxes it or not, make sure that we do something to help the bus system and get people to jobs, which is the underlying issue there that seems to be overshadowed a little bit about whether who's with the streetcar and, fixing roads and such, which I understand, I'm not saying are not important, but the underlying issue is making sure people get to jobs. And I would like to see a fix for the streetcar with some of these, underlying ideas. I think TransDev has some plans and that we have got to get to them.
Brian, this has been, I love it. I love the debate. I love the discussion. I have great respect for the work that you do in pushing for government transparency, for, questioning government, rooting out corruption in government. I don't necessarily agree with some things or some of your tweets, but those are tweets, so whatever. But I respect the work you do. So thank you. And thank you for coming into the podcast.
Absolutely. Thank you so much for having me. I really enjoy listening. And I'm sorry that this week's won't be that great of an addition, I guess.
Oh, thanks. I think that's not true.
Thanks again to Brian Shry for coming in. It's getting a little intense there. I was kind of getting a little annoyed.
I expected nothing less.
He was getting fired up, and you were getting fired up, and that was fun.
I felt like I was in moderator role a little bit.
You were in what?
Moderator role a little bit.
Oh. I certainly agree with him on the streetcar, but I think that's been clear, and I'm really tired of the streetcar.
I rode the streetcar on New Year's.
Oh, you did.
You know what? Honestly, it was super convenient. Parked at the Enquirer, which I parked
here. Oh, you were the one.
Stop. There were some people on it with me, but of course it was New Year's and not a typical day.
What a joke.
It We took it from like 5th and Walnut, and we went to Sart, which is my favorite restaurant in Cincinnati, up by Rheingeist.
Was your favorite restaurant.
I know. It's closing. It was so sad. It was its last night. I think it was the best meal I've ever had in Cincinnati.
A lot of restaurants closing, Shiri.
Well, that's like a thing at the new year. That happens. I think that does happen every year. These are some named ones this year for sure.
Dutch's in Hyde Park.
Yes. So very popular restaurant. Sart, of course, has made everyone's really top lists kind of at the end of the year for its amaze, for its foodiness and everything. But Keystone this year, too, closed.
Good riddance.
That was the thing for a while there.
I was an occasional patron of Dutch's. Much as it doesn't really fit my personality, I enjoyed a little Dutch's here and there.
You're a Mad Tree guy, I think, yes?
Yeah, Mad Tree, Braxton, 50 West.
The restaurant this
Home.
Year...
Home.
The restaurant...
My garage refrigerator.
This year that closed that I think was the most stunning one was Teller's. That was a mainstay.
Was that 2019?
Yeah, not that long ago, actually. Wow. And so it's going to be something else, but that's like been a mainstay. I think it was 25 years in the square.
Was there another place in Hyde or in OTR that closed?
Yeah, I forget what it is.
Yeah,
though.
I know. I'm drawing a blank too.
The list was long, though. Yes, you're right about that. But yeah, Sart was just an absolutely incredible meal.
Was it Kaze?
Yeah, it was Kaze. That's right. But they're actually going to repurpose. That's going to become a different restaurant. The Thunderdome Group is going to essentially just.
My recommendation to them is stronger drinks.
Restaurants. So.
their drinks were iffy at best.
You and I and some friends had an interesting evening at Kaze a couple summers ago.
That's not a conversation for a podcast or ever again. The patio there was lovely. Just leave that at that.
It wasn't anything nefarious. I mean, I want to make that clear.
Filing that one under you never know who you'll see when you go out.
That's exactly right. Exactly. That's a perfect way to say it.
What did you do on New
Year's? Let me go ahead and say what was so we saw a person out, and this guy starts in on me about a column I had written like a year and a half earlier. And I'm like, and then I start, you know, giving the guy grief, and it was just like you telling me to shut up, and
it was a lot. You know what? But
I mean, ultimately, it was. Yeah.
I told you this right before break. Ended up taking a lot of Ubers because if you're drinking, you never drive, as Brian pointed out. And I know you feel very serious. You did lose a friend to drunk driving.
Yes. Which, by the way, I want to make sure that I had.
We do this. Like I mean, one of my friends gave me an Uber gift card for Christmas because she knows. Like, I'm very serious about that.
As
but
am I.
If I get an Uber that is anywhere around the Inquirer, my Uber drivers love your column. This is just consistent. Like, it's like, oh, you work at the Inquirer? Oh my gosh, do you know Jason Williams? And I'm always like, I do. And I feel like we're usually two steps from them asking for me to get your autograph.
Popular with my mom and with Uber drivers. And sometimes not with my mom. But
yes.
Anyway.
Well, your mom doesn't need to love you all the time. She needs to give you good discipline.
That's exactly. It's just, there's a lot of tough love there. Anyway.
So it was a good New Year's. After Sart, then we basically walked back. We kind of wound through the city. It was teeming with people. Fountain Square was lovely. There were just a million big parties you could kind of see going on. It was freezing cold. Mm-hmm. But I actually enjoyed walking around the city and just was with Alex and just, you know, talking about the year and everything and just looking at everything. We ended up in Astor, was kind of our last stop at midnight, and then we went home.
Nice. What was your favorite Christmas gift?
Alex, I've lately been renting a lot of my clothing. Anybody wants to know about this? I'm a huge proponent of it. I love it. It's new clothes all the time and you're just renting. He did buy me something that was my favorite thing this year. He took notice and he bought me a purse that I absolutely loved this year that was supposed to be rented, but it became mine.
Nice. Very nice.
Are you renting your clothes, Jason?
My wife, speaking of, I was cleaning out my closet on Sunday.
And, me too. I did that. Yes. I needed to shut the door.
I'm a big, about twice a year, I take clothes to Plato's Closet and or Snooty Fox.
Yep.
I'm probably jinxing it. I've had great success with making money at selling my old clothes.
Me too. I do that.
I'm really, my wife's like, yeah, that's not going to happen this time. And I, there I was.
Oh.
$50. And anyway.
You know, you're supposed to buy new clothes with the clothes you get from selling clothes, right?
Well, actually, I got $47. Our babysitter, we have a babysitter one day a week, is 45. So I rarely carry cash.
So the New Year's babysitter.
That covered the baby. That covered the babysitter.
Expensive. Yeah.
New Year's babysitter.
Well, for New Year's Eve.
Oh, no, this was our.
You have to pay extra.
This was our regular babysitter on Wednesdays I take my son.
I do feel like, judging by the shoes that you and I have under our desk, we could have a fashion podcast. as a secondary.
Speaking of fashion, this is what I was trying to get at when I got sidetracked by my own getting down rabbit holes. So Bethany says to me, she's like, why do you, like, I have a whole closet full of clothes that you, I think, Sherry, you would look at and be like, good Lord, why don't you wear any of this stuff? And Bethany's like, and yet you still wear the same three or four things all the time. And I'm like, you know, if I think back through my life, I've always been like that. I've been a clothes, my grandfather owned his own men's clothing store back in the little town up the river from where my mom grew up. And it was, I mean, he was a haberdasher, and this was good. I mean, back when small businesses and small towns were really thriving, and I just kind of got the clothes bug from him. So I have all these clothes and I buy clothes, and yet I still wear the same three or four things.
I feel like you might be like me in the morning, although I kind of plan out my outfits the night before. I mean, I'm starting work basically from the time I get up. I wake up to text messages, there's calls, and like I'm just kind of hustling out the door usually. And so there's not always the time to be like, oh, you know, this, that, or getting ready, because we're just in work mode from the second we wake up.
Totally. And I like to say, in fairness to me, I it looks like I wear the same, but I have like the same,
all the same things.
But I have the same pair of pants, like three or four of those pants. So of the exact same pants.
I feel like you have a very athletic look.
I've been doing the athleisure
we're writers.
Last
what the heck?
Summer and
yeah.
But I always have my.
I think ties are going away just in most places.
I know. I've noticed that too. But a lot of even things that like I see people like on forums or panels or even on national TV.
The whereas open collar, maybe a sport coat, but an open collar, and no, totally.
You know who's a big proponent of that, and I think looks fantastic with it.
Burl Love.
I didn't even say it, and Silent Phil's over there ready to hit the Burl button. Burl has mastered that look, and Burl, if you're listening, you look fantastic in the no tie sport coat.
No, it works in today's world. Yeah, you know where you do have to dress up? City Hall. It does call for it. The mayor sets the tone, wears a suit every day, and that is still a place that, you know, kind of demands, you know, a certain decorum. It's also, maybe not decorum. I'm still talking about clothes here. you have to be dressed up to go to City Hall.
Anyway. Anything else?
I do want to give out. This is my favorite thing of the week. I don't think it's that so Cincinnati, but I'm just going to say my favorite thing. The Enquirer, for people who still get the print paper, which the Coolidges do, is going back to the broadsheet, which is basically the big paper. It's very exciting. It's getting printed somewhere else in like kind of a big change up in Gannett and how things are being printed and where. But the end result is the paper in your driveway is this much larger paper. It is so great for displaying stories, and our team of photographers is just, it's the best around, and their awards, they show it, international awards, state awards, national awards, they're amazing, and this bigger format just really is going to showcase their work as it should be. I'm super excited.
Yeah, me too. I love all of our platforms, and I think this is just adds to our brand, and I know a lot of people had gotten. It was interesting because I was talking with one of our print planners, Jim Calhoun, about this yesterday. Like we were reminiscing about when we went to the, I call it the tabloid edition, but they officially call it the compact. and how I remember
I haven't heard either of those names in a long time.
I remember how people were really up in arms about it. I think, but then I saw some comments this time like, hey, there people had gotten used to it, but it's almost like we're okay with this, or we're okay with you bringing back the broadsheet. Yes. So that was good. That was really good to see. So.
People should check it out on Sunday. I think we put a lot of care into this week's paper. And so that's, I think, where it's going to be showcased the most there.
Good things happening here in 2020 at the Cincinnati.com, Cincinnati Inquirer. We are all over 2020 election coverage locally. So many big races, which we've talked about and we'll talk more about coming up.
Scott Wortman, the county reporter, has been out of the gate with who's going to be the commissioner. Todd Portune officially resigned.
Yep.
As we've reported, you know, a lot that did happen. And so it's going to be who's next. Victoria Parks, his aide, is going to fill in for him for a little bit. It looks like that's going to be the decision. The candidates themselves are supporting that. And so he's already been writing a lot about that. And we're on day two here of the new year.
Yeah, it's crazy. It's going to be an intense year. Stick with us. If you don't have the... if you enjoy the podcast, you don't have a subscription yet, please consider that. We're running a deal on, we're always running deals on that. So thank you so much, and we will catch you next week.